G'day, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Kevin Mathis.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Smith from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin and you're listening to Not the British.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show, our first of 2018, and we wish you all a very prosperous and healthy new year in the world of sport. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And it should be a good year ahead. I mean, we've got the Football World Cup coming up. We've had the Ashes series. There's always plenty of happening in sport.
Hockey World Cup. That's coming
true.
Up.
That's true. Hockey World Cup.
And Champions Trophy.
True. And they should be good as well. And I'm going to turn our attention, though, first of all, to the Ashes, John. As you know, I
Cricket.
Cannot abandon my English roots. And I have to say, I thought England were pretty poor in that series. I couldn't believe James Anderson at the press conference after the series trying to make out that England were really close in the series and it was a closely contested series. Now, there were, I will give him his due, there were moments where if England had capitalised on situations, they could have gone on and had a better performance. But the truth was they never did. When those situations came up, they floundered, they failed, whereas Australia didn't. I mean, Stephen Smith was superb. And you just got to look at the stats in the whole situation that, you know, Australia had four bowlers, took over 20 wickets each. England didn't have a single bowler take 20 wickets. James Anderson was the most with 17 in the series. And then if we look at...
And that's bolstered by one innings.
Yeah. And then if you also look at the batting, again, it was pretty bad. They had three batsmen with an average of over 40. And when you take into account that nobody had an average of over 50, that is pretty poor. And then if you looked at the Australians, they had two batsmen with averages of over 100, and then I think from memory it was three batsmen with averages of over 50 in that. So that again just shows how dominant Australia were in comparison to England. And I look at it and I think we've touched on it before, but what the results, and I wrote this on notthefootyshow.com, the amount of touring teams that have won a game. You've got to go back almost, I think it's to 2013, for the last touring team overseas anywhere to win on the road. So teams are struggling on the road to win a series. That's to win a series. They've won test matches, but to win a series. Now, my question with that says to me that all these teams are not preparing adequately when they come overseas. And I think if you look at that England team, to me, on this tour, and the buck has to stop with Trevor Bayliss, the coach, because I don't think they prepared properly. I mean, you've got James Anderson was on his fourth tour. Surely he knows how to bowl in Australia by now. And yet his average, I think, was around 35, or his economy rate was 35. He took 17. No, I think it was his average was 35, which is not good as an opening bowler. 17 wickets. Broads was even worse. And then if you looked at the other bowlers that they had, nobody really did anything for them except for Overton, who I thought showed some promise. And then their batsmen, again, just did not perform. And I don't think they prepared properly. And I think it was a bit of a con to me when they say that they were competitive and were really strong in the series. I thought they were weak. And I also, in my opinion, I thought Joe Root's captaincy was not good either.
I thought the dismissal of Joe Root in the last innings of the last test summed up their tour. They were almost there. It was he almost got a century. The shot he got out to for a bloke on that score was a terrible shot. And it just seemed to encapsulate everything that had gone wrong for England. You know, you can't say they didn't have a crack, although question marks might be asked about Stuart Broad's first two tests, because he didn't even look like he'd got off the plane yet.
But again, I'll throw this one in the mix, John, and I'll be honest, it sticks in my craw a little bit. So you've got Jimmy Anderson, who I think, okay, he did okay at times, but he still wasn't outstanding. He certainly wasn't up to the standards that he set. But then if you look at his record in Australia, he was never going to perform over here. Here's a bowler that relies on swing and movement off the pitch. Two of the things you're not going to get. And it was no coincidence that he took his first ever five wickets in Australia in the day-nighter in Adelaide when the
at
ball
night.
Was moving around. Yeah, at night. So that was no coincidence. But what I don't
in
like...
In fairness to Anderson, he he bowled well, though, in the sense that he bowled good. He wasn't getting tonked. He didn't bowl badly. You know, maybe he didn't bowl to the expectations we have of Jimmy Anderson, but he wasn't
bad. But he was
bad.
Never going to, and that's a good point. My belief.
But he wasn't bad. He bowled a pretty good line, and none of the batsmen really ever took to him.
No.
You know, so he did what he could, you could argue.
No, that's true, but then I look at now, you know, that the Ashes are over, the one dayers are starting up, and he's been given a job with the ABC. And you suddenly go, well, hang on a sec. Was he here to play cricket, or is he here to sort of carve a niche for his career when he hangs up his boots? And I think, to me, we're seeing this a little bit too much, and I don't actually like it, even though I work in the media. I think you're either a professional athlete, and you focus on being a professional athlete, and when you step aside, you then go into the media. Because the other thing is, as a viewer, as a listener on the radio, whatever, you know damn well, John, he is never going to go to town and criticise his teammates.
You wouldn't think so.
It's just not going to happen, you know?
What I think is...
And I just don't like that. I'm now looking at it going, well, was he here just because this was his farewell trip to Australia? Now he's just focused on trying to secure something when he leaves the sport. It just doesn't sit right with me.
Well, you've also got this situation where you've got people who are essentially retired, and they're referred to as retired, but still playing 2020 cricket. That's the addendum placed on the end of it. And you've got guys like Brendan McCullum, who's doing his commentary during the Big Bash, and then he's playing his games, and there's this sort of twilight zone there where they can do this, because in people's minds, oh, McCullum's actually retired because he's not playing international cricket for us. He's just running around playing 2020s. So it doesn't count the same way inside your head, you know?
But this is the thing again. Then if that's the case, then let's not give T20 the credibility that we're giving it and having it that it is an international credible tournament, which it was never meant to be. And if you go back, it was almost meant to be a bit of a giggle, a hit and a giggle. Was how it was described. Bit of fun, entertainment, circus has come to town, and we'll all enjoy it. But I agree with you that you either are retired or you're going to focus on a career in broadcasting. And I think the sad thing is when you've got these people that are caught in that twilight zone, what they come out with is pretty insipid, because they're not going to have a go at their teammates and the guys that they're still playing with, because of course they're going to turn on them. And there was a brilliant article, and I'm trying to remember the name of the Irish rugby player, who when he'd retired and he said, well, I would drop so and so, and he goes, he was my mate, and he came around my house and said, what the hell are you doing going on that? He said, listen, nothing personal, you're not playing well. He goes, do you seriously think you deserve your place in the team at the moment the way you're playing? And he goes, we had a discussion, him and his wife didn't speak to me for about a month, and then he realised that I had a job to do, had to give my opinion, that's what I was paid to do. But he said, it's very difficult for you to change from being a player and moving into that sphere. And I think that as a viewer on TV, and as I said, as a listener on the radio, I want to hear people who are not afraid to make an opinion, have an opinion, and are prepared to actually talk about it and give us an insight rather than worrying about upsetting their mates.
Yeah, I see your point. I have a bigger issue with player managers being commentators.
Well, yeah, that shouldn't happen.
It should never happen, but it does.
That definitely shouldn't.
And it happens in all across this country in lots of sports, and it's just so irritating.
Well, and also I think there's another one there where you have to watch, where some of the pundits and some of the commentators actually have the same management as some of the players. And so you know, and I know this in some sports, where you know that pundit is never going to criticise that player because they share the same manager. And if he does, his manager's going to be on the line going, hey, hang on a sec, he's one of our boys, you pump him up, you don't put him down. Now, again, these are conflicts of interest which shouldn't be there. And, you know, I don't like, and I mean, I'm a freelancer, but I don't like this cross-pollination where you've got people that work for one media outlet and are employed on a full-time basis, and then they crop up working for another one, and you go, well, how can that work? You know, how are they getting two wages from two different organisations?
Yeah, I know my daughter works for a large grocery chain in this country, and when she went for the job at this large grocery chain, she told them that she had a job at another retailer, but it wasn't a grocery retailer, and that... the comment from the employer was, oh, no, that's all right. They're a sister company. That's fine. If it had been the other large grocery retailer in this country, they would have had a problem with it. And that's selling groceries, mate. I mean, why shouldn't the same apply in sport?
But absolutely, and it's why you see in so many big corporations, you know, if for example you were the CEO of Hockey Australia and you were going to resign and go and become the CEO of another sport, the chances are they would say, leave now, thanks for your resignation, because they know that you could glean information.
Oh, exactly. You're in
a, especially if it's a competitive sport against the one that you're working at. And I mean, it happens in industry where that happens. If you're leaving to go to a competitor, empty your desk today, goodbye, thank you very much.
Oh, well, you know, you could have some sort of crazy situation where the head of a sport is also on an Olympic committee or something like that. A real conflict going on.
We could indeed. But anyway, look, we could talk about that. But what was your opinion? Did you seriously think England performed well? I thought they were under par. And as you say, never quite made it. Australia were far superior.
Oh, they were. I thought the Australian bowlers, I'm not sure that they bowled that much better than England, but they bowled balls that got batsmen out. Some of the balls that England guys got out to were real jaffers. And I didn't see enough jaffers coming out of the hands of the English bowlers.
Look, I'm a big fan of Cummins. I think he is a wonderful bowler.
Doesn't he look good, though?
Yeah. And I think Hazelwood's good as well.
Aggressive.
Yeah. Now, Lyon amazes me. I've got to be honest. I had a big argument with a guy up in Asia who is an Aussie who works for one of the TV stations up there. And he was going, Nathan Lyon has got to be the best off-spinner that cricket's seen. And I was like, give me a break. I don't agree with that one. But then I went through looking at the averages and the stats, and if you do it based on that,
he's sure as hell up there. Yeah.
Now, but he doesn't turn it that much.
He's starting to.
I agree. But he did turn a few here. But I still think, and I was talking to someone the other day, I remember when I used to read coaching books when I was young, and it was Sir Leonard Hutton said, when you're playing spin bowlers, your bat should be like a wet flannel, that you absorb the ball as it comes in, and also you had your bat behind or alongside your pad. Now, you look at the amount of wickets Lyon picked up where the English batsmen, their bats were in front of their pad, they were playing with hard, stiff hands, and that's why they were getting edges and popping the ball up. And I'd said preparation, and it's either a technique thing or they've not prepared properly for wickets that bounce a little bit more. And I just think their preparation was poor.
Yep, I think you're probably right there. And I don't think they were helped by the... In the two games they had as warm-ups, they weren't up against quality... when you're coming up against Hazelwood, Cummins and Stark in a test match, you need to get some quality bowling at you. And that probably let them down a long way. You did mention there, though, you're talking about away tests and... I think I actually made a comment on that post, and
yeah, you did.
I did. Yeah, I thought I did. We should remember that winning away from home should be hard. It is hard. It's supposed to be hard. Maybe not as hard as some teams are making it out at the moment, but you know, the odds are that the home team's going to win, and it is a tremendous performance from an away team, especially in a sport like cricket, to come to a country and win a test series. But the more interesting stat I put on that post, I'd like to know, is the number of wickets that have fallen to cross-bat shots since the inception of 2020 cricket. Because there's a lot of that guys playing cross-bat. That one of Joe Root's where he just slapped it straight, that still comes back to haunt me. That's a 2020 shot. That's a guy trying to chase runs.
I mean, I think I did reply to your comment, and I didn't go through all of it, but I looked at some of the stats from... I think it was just the Ashes series, and if you look, since T20 started, only one series had been won away from home in that time. But I can't do the cross-bat shots. But I agree with you. I think there's no doubt it's had an impact. I don't think batsmen know how to apply an innings. And that's where I give my credit to the Australian batsmen, because I think they've learnt that and they have far more application. I think Root's got the application, some of the England players, but they seem to lose it at the vital moment, and that's the difference between the greats and the also-rans.
And you had a couple of guys in that, you know, the young opener and
Vincent Stoneham. I think both of those were a little bit unlucky.
And even Milan. I mean, those guys...
Milan had a great series. Yeah. I think he was... Him and Bairstow, to me, were the two shining lights with Overton.
They showed that they had the temperament, but not the concentration, if that's the right word.
Yeah, and they did get a couple of decisions were okay.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's another thing. The DRS... Oh, not the DRS. Yeah, it is the DRS, isn't it? Gee, there's still a lot to work out there, isn't there?
There is indeed, and we discussed that before, and no doubt we'll discuss it again.
Oh, yeah, it's a crazy thing.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and it's time for us to introduce our first guest, who we actually forgot to mention at the top of the show, and I apologise for that, but we're going to talk a little bit of baseball now, because the Australian Baseball League is looking to expand and have Asian inclusion, which they're hoping will also attract sponsors and also television deals, and also help grow the game in Australia. Now, it's an interesting proposition, and it's slightly different from the other propositions we've seen from other sports where they're looking to go on the road and play in other countries. We thought we'd get the true information from the CEO, and that is Cam Vale. Cam Vale, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, obviously exciting times. You're now, having moved across from Hockey Australia, now the CEO of Australian Baseball, and there's talk in November, you were talking about expanding the league into Asia, which sounds a really exciting prospect and would really revitalize the league. What's the thought behind it?
Yeah, so since coming into the job with the ABL has been a major focus for me coming on board. And look, we're in our eighth season at the moment, so good stability. We've previously been backed by Major League Baseball to get the ABL back up and running. But at the moment, you know, the teams need to grow, and both, you know, commercially and really from that sustainability perspective. So the push into Asia makes a lot of sense with a perfect winter league to Japan, Korea and Taiwan. These massive, very fanatical fan bases, and we're seeing it already this season. So, you know, it's really to take the league to the next level. Still the Australian Baseball League. It's still a really important part of what we do here domestically. But like a lot of sports, the focus on Asia is really important to where we want to go. And for us, there's the real tangible links in what we can do, creating partnerships with professional teams out of the NPB, which is the Japanese league, the KBO, the Korean league, or the CPBL out of Taiwan. So it's a great opportunity. It's staring us in the face, and you know, our stakeholders are behind it. So it's a two-part process, really, trying to have our six existing teams, which are run effectively by the state bodies, licensed out, franchised, if you will, and also looking at a couple of expansion opportunities, which could involve Asian teams playing in Australian locations. So probably important to note, it's an Australian league that possibly with our friends across the ditch, New Zealand, involved, but outside of them, all the teams would be based in Australia. It could be that whether it's Asian ownership or alignment, exchanging of players, that's where we want to push.
Having sort of read the initial thoughts, it said you might take the teams to rural areas. Are you also looking at, you know, you've obviously got a team in Brisbane, would you maybe look Gold Coast or Townsville? When you say rural areas, is it not necessarily in a country town somewhere?
Yeah, no, so the regional push is very much around, if you like, away from the five major capital cities. And Canberra's been a great example that, you know, our smallest market team from a population size, but have been very successful off the field. They've also been very successful on the field, and it's a great example of what I think we can take baseball to the people in areas like Geelong, Gold Coast, Wollongong. We've had some really good success. Tasmania, you know, so many parts of the country that I think are denied the opportunity to be represented in national leagues, and the baseball product being, you know, it's a 12-week product, not a you know, sort of 6-7 month season, and the partnerships we can create with professional teams in Asia and still with Major League Baseball and their teams also give us a lower cost model to create these teams. And therefore, regional areas are really, really important to us. And I selfishly as a CEO see an opportunity because I think a number of them are being denied opportunities, whether it's in cricket or soccer or basketball or other sports that are considering expansion. And I think for us, we offer a great opportunity. And, you know, we're very close this year to having a South Korean team play in the ABL. They would have been based at a regional location. So they also can bring, if you like, not just the playing, but that baseball strength to try to combine being the team for that region at the same time as they represent their country back into, in this case, it would have been South Korea.
You talked about trying to change the teams within the Australian Baseball League from being sort of state-run organisations to private or a franchise-type setup. Are you seeing that more rather than having a private owner, more having it as a corporate owner like we have in Japan and Korea? Because to me, that's the only way forward that you could get companies that are trading in Australia to own those teams, or even American companies that are in Australia owning those teams.
Yeah, so and to the credit of our state, so Major League Baseball, when they withdrew from owning the league a couple of years ago, effectively the six existing teams then fell to the control of the state baseball bodies. And state baseball bodies have done a really good job to continue last season and this season, but it's not a long-term solution because of the pressures they have to deliver to their core people, which is their members, the local competitions and growing grassroots. So they're doing a great job juggling having these professional teams, but ultimately it's not a core responsibility for a state baseball body. So we see them partnering, and therefore the transferring of the licenses to this franchise private ownership model is the key. What we've got to avoid, we've got to learn from mistakes in the past. So, you know, a lot of people have said to me, look, this was tried in the 90s, this was part of the reason the league went under, when people, you know, get involved maybe for the right reasons, can't afford to run teams, spend too much money on teams, don't have that real business philosophy to being successful. So in answer to what sort of entities might own or run these teams, I think we're looking at diversity. It could be a team is under a high net worth individual. It could be a team is under another sporting club in Australia. We've had some great interest from some of the biggest sporting teams in Australia, overseas teams through Asia and the US, corporate entities. Yes, the Japanese and the Korean and the Taiwanese models are largely based on business-backed teams. We'd still love to look at a true member-based team or a community-based team. So there's a lot of different ways, and I think the key in any of these models, whether it's baseball or any of the other leagues in Australia, look for diversity in your ownership group. Don't be at the mercy of, you know, one change in some condition. You know, we have another stock exchange or share market crash or whatever, and it wipes out a heap of people because it's a similar sort of background. And the other thing for us that's really important is don't do it because you can afford to lose money running a team. I want to avoid that at every opportunity. Look at how you can grow the team, whether it's its profitability or the value in holding that license, because we want people to be successful out of this, the individuals or the companies involved. So it's got to have a mindset that is, yes, it makes sense. Asia, baseball, pushing regionally, growing the sport here, the glamour that we have of being a North American sport, all of those things tell us how you're going to be successful with it, not, yeah, I can afford to run a team. But that's not what we're looking at.
Would you see as well that therefore, so say you might have a corporation wants to own a team in one city on the East Coast, but over in Adelaide or in Perth where we are, it might want to be a community-based team. Would you have no problems having a mixture of, you know, a sort of corporate ownership and a community ownership?
Yeah, definitely. I think it brings out, as I said, it brings out strengths in a league to be able to grow. It certainly reduces some of the risks that you can have in these models. We know that. We again, you can't be naive in this country to not know that teams under private ownership or franchise models that have got themselves into some strife. So we're really open and to the different ways it can work, because different markets will respond to different things. So a good example is Perth. Perth, you know, especially during my background of hockey, has, you know, such a parochial market for its teams in national leagues, which is at times very, very different to how teams are represented in, say, a Melbourne or a Sydney. And therefore, you look to the strength of what that might bring. And I think, as I said, we are looking, you know, at all options. It's a bit of a cliche to say that, but we're not going in with a narrow view of, you know, well, you need X amount of $1 million to do it, or what's your connection to baseball. How do you make a sporting team under these circumstances work in this country? It's an Australian league that's an international sport that's pushing into Asia, that's trying to expand its league. What are the strengths that you as an entity can bring to being successful with the license? We want to see everyone be successful, and if they're not, or we may selectively choose, if we don't find the right partners, to retain some of those licenses ourselves, until we can find the right partners to take it over in each of their respective markets.
If we look at the Australian Baseball League, when Major League Baseball was involved, and I believe even now with the partnership, they've used this league to bring on young talent, to give them game time so that they can get them into the big leagues when they go back to the US. Are the Asian sort of teams there, or the Asian confederations that are looking to come down here, are they seeing it very much as the same thing, to bring on their young, talented players?
Yeah, very similar. I mean, it's MLB, and the MLB clubs certainly look at our league as a development league. There's no doubt about that. And whether it's players that have been injured, or largely some of the younger development players that they're trying to fast-track coming to our league, which creates great excitement. You know, that you could be looking, and a lot of times are, one of the next, you know, big Major League Baseball stars. So certainly we're seeing a similar approach, or from the interest so far, from particularly in Japan and Korea and Taiwan. But I think there'll also be a mix of, you know, we've got a player in Adelaide, Tarzan, who's, from Taiwan. You know, he's a big name player. It's, you know, he's at towards the end of his career, I think it would be fair to say. I think he's 40 years old. So it's sort of, he's coming out, he's a named player. It's the finish of his career, and he's still offering a lot of value to the team and the league. So I think we'll see a mix, but predominantly it will be these development players, the next players that are going to be in the majors, whether it's the US or Japan or Korea or Taiwan. That's the focus. And look, we have a similar approach here. A lot of our Australian focus is on the next crop, the development players. We get a lot of our major leaguers or professional players back, which is great, but it's certainly a league that's about, it's a winter league, so it has to serve to a large degree our development focus of all the stakeholders that are involved.
Do you feel that these plans are at the right time? When you consider that baseball's been out of the Olympics now for a while, it's going to be back in, as you would expect, in Japan, which is a huge baseball nation, for the 2020 Olympics. This is a really good chance for you to just lift the game. I'm sure it's never going to be a mainstream sport in Australia, but you could lift it to another level because you're building towards Tokyo.
Yeah, I think, look, the timing is right, because in a lot of ways we've gone through the, you know, the rebirth of the league and a lot of the start-up and the set-up and getting, you know, 8th year seems a long time, but really in the maturity of a national league, it's really not a long period of time. So we've gone through that first phase. The second phase should be about two key things. It should be about, first and foremost, sustainability. So have you got the league to a sustainable point that, you know, the whole, is this going to continue? Is this team going to be around, et cetera, has gone away. The next phase has got to be about significant growth. And that shift for us, not just, yeah, we're growing numbers, but yes, it's lifting the standard of the league. It's lifting the broadcast of the league. And I think that's where the opportunity is right. We've had a big focus and a great partnership with MLB. We're not losing that. We're now really looking to integrate Asia into our league. And I think this is our opportunity in a unique way. A lot of Australian sports talk about the importance of Asia. Hopefully what we will show in the next few months is that our connection is quite deep, it's quite strong, and with some seriously important players in these markets, and where, yes, it's a development league in a lot of ways to them, but it's going to be really important to them, and some of the brands hopefully associated with our league will show that it's going to the next level.
The thing I find really interesting is you're looking to bring the Asian teams to Australia. We've seen Super Rugby, the costs of having, when they expanded that to include Argentina and Japan, it's probably the thing that, to be honest, has killed Super Rugby, just the sheer cost. We've got hockey, which you were involved in, now looking at their Pro League, which is, you know, 9 teams playing home and away over 6 months. It's a very difficult thing to make that financially viable. So I think the idea you've got, was it that experience that made you go with this model?
Well, look, it's certainly, and having been involved a lot with the Pro League in hockey, you know, the excitement of what that league can be is that one of the big challenges is obviously the cost of travel. And so for us in this league, look, I think it's a combination of, it is an Australian league. So for us to be, we couldn't afford to be sending teams to play in Japan or Korea. Part of it is logistics too. Those countries, it's their winter, outside of indoor venues, you know, it's not suitable to be playing baseball. So, but what I really like about this is the opportunity of going, again, all Australian sports talk about Asia. We all talk about it in different ways, and we all know it's important. But it's not just a numerical percentage game. It's not about, well, if we got 1% of the 200 million people in these three countries, we'll be successful. It's got to be more targeted than that. So we're looking at key partners to bring into this country to try to create, and people say it's a big challenge, but it's also a great opportunity to challenge that mindset of it's an Asian team playing in Australia, but it's from Australian presence. It brings potentially a team to a region in Australia that's not part of a national league. So it's got an identity, let's say, in Lismore, a regional town in New South Wales, and baseball's got a strong connection to. So Lismore could have a team that's representing Lismore, but it happens to be drawing on the strength of it's a predominantly Korean team or Japanese team. And I think the great opportunity, people go, oh, that's too hard, it won't work. I mean, the things in sport that are successful are generally the things that people say are too hard and don't work. So it is a little bit about the reducing the travel, if you like, and we couldn't afford to do it, to have a current, you know, to have sending our Australian teams to Korea to play. But I think it's also the opportunity we represent as a league to again, change the dynamics of how Australian sport engages with Asia in a way that is absolutely about delivering in this country, but at the same time capitalising on the broadcast strength in those countries, the business connections, the tourism, the government, whatever else it might be.
Just one final question, Cam. I mean, we used to have the sort of champions competition between Japan, Australia and Korea, I think were the main countries that were in there, and Taiwan as well. That seems to have disappeared. With the Asian teams coming into Australia, do you see that being regenerated and maybe coming back to life?
Look, we'd love to. We'd certainly like to take a lead in trying to get that concept back up and running. And, you know, we'd be very heavily dependent on those other three countries and their leagues as far as timing and whatever else. But, yeah, look, it's something we're looking at. We're also looking at, you know, we've developed a really strong connection with the CPBL in Taiwan, the Taiwanese Professional League. And, you know, we could even look at things like the ABL champion playing the CPBL champion, and having that sort of crossover event. I know rugby league have done it quite well. Have, you know, Australian teams gone to England in the past, and, you know, I think there's plenty of ways that we can look at that deeper engagement. Asian league would be phenomenal, but for us, we might bridge the gap with a smaller step by potentially ABL champion versus CPBL champion. Probably best for us to play it at the end of our season, when our teams are together, which is coming into the pre-season of the CPBL. So, you know, that concept this time in 12 months is something that we'll explore. But in a perfect world, yeah, the Asian series would be great to get off the ground again and get some good support from government. We could certainly look at it, or some of those bigger entities around Australia that deal with those three markets.
Well, Cam Vale, thank you very much for your time.
No worries. Thanks, Ashley. Good to speak to you under a different sport.
Hi, I'm Derek Underwood, and this is the Not the Footy Show.
There was a guy who knew about bowling in Australia.
Absolutely. Deadly Derek.
Yes.
Well, that was Cam Vale, the CEO of the Australian Baseball League, and really interesting, I think, John, listening to him. Obviously, the Tokyo Olympics, having baseball back in, is really going to help them boost the sport. And I like the idea of what they're doing, is rather than trying to take the teams in Australia on the road into the likes of Japan, Korea, Chinese Taipei, etc., they're realizing it would be better to have the professional teams there send down a team to play in the Australian Baseball League, which may well then attract viewership from those regions and also help raise the standard in Australia. And I think it's a pretty good idea, because the only way, as you know, in any sport that you can improve is when you test yourself against better players.
Absolutely, and it's a proactive move, which is always good. You like seeing sports associations be proactive, but we're at a real juncture of where sport is at in our society, I think, with the change in what's happening with broadcasting and moving into this digital realm and the internet age and all those sorts of things. TV stations are going to become a thing of the past, essentially. I heard a very interesting conversation the other day with about new technologies, etc., and that people aren't buying televisions anymore. They're actually not physically buying a TV. A lot of young people don't have a TV. They access all of their entertainment through a tablet or a phone. They are watching series of television shows on their tablets, and TV to them now means a series of shows in episodic situation that they can access
when
they want to watch it. It doesn't mean sitting down in front of a box watching what you're told you have to watch by the TV programmers.
Well, I can tell you that when we live streamed the Sultan of Johor Cup, you get the stats on what device people watched it on. And it was actually very interesting that on that, I think the number one device was actually a tablet. Number one was mobile phone, Then tablet was, I think, third. Computer was second. But the TV actually was quite high, so people were watching it through their TV on a computer network. So it was actually the TV screen was there. But it was the statistics really surprised me how high they were on those, on the computer and on the mobile phone were really, really high. And I was quite surprised at how high they were.
Just in my case, I don't have pay television subscription. And I've been discovering over the last 18 months, I watch very little television now. If I do watch television, or sit in front of a television, I'm watching things through my computer, like you say. I've got that plugged into my smart TV and I can just watch whatever I like. And the traditional media landscape is changing so rapidly, and sports have to be on top of it if they're going to survive and succeed. And baseball's having a crack at it.
Yeah, the other thing I found really interesting was, of course, the model that he's talking about, how they're going to have ownership of the clubs. At the moment, the state bodies own each of the clubs in the Australian Baseball League. What they would like to see those into, and as he said, he doesn't want to see people who are going to own a club and it's going to be based on the stock market as to whether they stay involved in the sport. They'd like to get corporations involved, which if you look in Asia, the teams are owned by major corporations. And I think with baseball, that might be the way to go. It could be a good way to go. But he's also encouraging community buy-in. So let's have community-owned clubs. But they're not going to be as rigid as the A-League, where, you know, the A-League said this is how the ownership structure will work. He's saying, look, if the right people come in that want to own it, and that it is a group, or if it's going to be a corporation, you know, we'll look at it. He goes, but we're not going to just give away the teams just because a private owner wants it, because that's very risky. And I think it was very interesting talking to Cam off air, was he was saying that he's looking at the other sports, observing the problems that they have and trying to learn from those. And to me, that's the sign of a good CEO.
It is. Maybe we should get him into hockey at some stage.
Well, he was there. Again. He was Hockey Australia.
Yeah, well, let's not go through that story, shall we? We've seen what a schmozzle that's turned into.
But just one other thing I wanted to say, John, and you just touched on that before, was with the whole TV thing. Now, the interesting thing is Super Rugby is supposedly going to be folding in the next 2 years, that South Africa don't want to be a part of it anymore. The contract expires for Sanzar. Now, what I'm hearing is that the rugby players are being told, guys, you're not going to be earning what you're earning now when that deal comes to an end. because, as you said, TV money is not going to be there. Now, I think the interesting thing is going to be see which sports, and I think you're going to see a very, very, we know that there's a sort of level now where there's the first tier sports and there's the second tier, but I think the gap between first tier and second tier is going to get bigger, because those that like your Major League Baseball, NBA, English Premier League, or the European leagues in football, they're always still going to attract money. I think it's going to come down. They're not going to be able to pay the rest of, if the TV viewership isn't there, unless they get a digital platform that they're putting the games through. But I think the other sports are going to have to be really clever how they maintain the salaries for their athletes.
Oh, and that's going to be crucial. It's certainly one of the things hockey's going to have to look at if this so-called pro league goes ahead, is how much athletes are paid and how they're going to ensure that there's some sort of parity across the whole league. When you're talking about players who are playing for national teams, you know, and that are sponsored by governments, are governments going to be happy to be told by the FIH how much they have to pay their players? That's going to be an interesting conversation.
Now, this is one of the areas that I have concerns with the Pro League, is I just don't understand where the money is going to come from, not only to pay the players, but to pay the travel costs
and
to play around the world and the accommodation.
Food.
Yeah, all of that. And then also to host the games. Now, to host a game, there is a cost attributed to that. And I think what Hockey Australia, let's use as an example, I think they're expecting that the government of Victoria will put in so much money because this is going to be to a TV audience worldwide. But they're not going to keep doing it year in, year out if you're doing that. It's not going to happen because governments are doing
it
tough. Now, if you look at the TV revenue, now my understanding is that the way it's been set up, and I think there's, because Star at the moment, and because India are not involved, we don't have Star Sports in now. Jason McCracken, the outgoing CEO of the FIH, he said there was
allegedly outgoing.
No, I believe he is going. Anyway, but in 6 months' time, anyway. But my understanding is that 66% of the revenue from the TV deals is going to the FIH. Now, that means that there's 33% of the revenues as being shared around 11 national associations. Now, we were breaking that down based on a figure slightly below the 150 million that Jason McCracken spoke about. Now, it worked out with the figure that we were working with, which I was working on around 134 million, because that's a figure I've heard. Now, if you did that, that's only 4 million would go to Hockey Australia to run two teams in that competition. Now, that's not a lot of money when you think to go, and this, I've got this figure from somebody in Hockey Australia, was saying to send the teams to Europe is going to cost about $500,000 to play in the competitions there. So
that's only one trip to Europe. If they have to make two trips to Europe, that's $1 million.
Yeah, and then they've still got to pay the players on top. They've still got to organise the games here. Now, obviously, some of the teams in Europe are in a slightly better position because they can travel by bus, or they can, you know, it's not so far to travel. But I just wonder where the money's coming from.
And that's, for the European teams, it'll be fine, like you say. But, and they'll start to feel the pinch when they suddenly have to go to Australia and Buenos Aires.
And New Zealand as well.
And New Zealand and America. So they're going to have to do the transatlantic as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, America's not cheap.
Well, and then you've got to look as well at Pakistan playing in Scotland. How are they going to make that pay?
Well, that's going to be interesting. I mean, I know that the Pakistan Federation is happy that they're there, in the sense that there's a large Pakistani community already in Glasgow. I think they're playing Glasgow, yeah. And I think that they see it as the, you know, if they have to put up with being in Scotland, they'll do it.
In the league. I understand that, but I still think it's going to be very hard to make money.
Oh, it will be. No one's going to make money out of it. I don't understand this. During the Hockey World League finals, for the men, it was on YouTube. It was, and depending on which country you were in, depending on what broadcast rights, depending on whether you had to go for the pay-per-view or whether it was freely available via YouTube in your country. Now, YouTube Singapore had It was free to YouTube. So if you could get to a server in Singapore, you could watch all of those games for free live. Okay. Now this was a global thing. So anybody could have watched it that they liked. 350 people were watching a Hockey World League game at the finals. 350. A free service. Now I don't know what the...
Was that just in Singapore though?
Well, it's the YouTube servers that run out of Singapore, so it would take in people from other countries.
So was it,
as well.
But was the link an FIH link or?
Oh yeah. It was the FIH YouTube channel, FIH YouTube channel. So if you could watch it for free, that's where you'd be going. Anywhere around the world would be to that YouTube channel. 350 people. Now mate, that's not paying for a pro league. I don't know what they got on the subscription services, but I would imagine if they're only getting 350 people watching a live game for free, what are the chances that they've got people tuning in, hundreds of thousands tuning in, watching it and paying for it? Now that was just one game. I think the final got up a little, it was over 500, but even that's a pretty pathetic figure. And that's where hockey's problem lies. It's getting people to tune in. They can't get them to watch the games. And that goes back to the hockey community, by the way. That's not the FIH's fault. That's not National Association's fault. That's up to the hockey community to engage with their own game.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? It's a really good...
It is.
And I think the other thing that we don't take into account sometimes is that these national associations, there are so many platforms now. And I remember talking to someone from one of those, and they go, they don't jump when a new thing comes out. They don't immediately jump on it because they said it may be like a comet. It'll just fly you across the sky on the internet for 6 months or a year, and then it's obsolete. And so you have to be very careful which ones you invest in, which have a longer term view, etc., to try and maximize what you're going to get. Now, the other thing is, you and I both know, John, when you go on to websites, or if you're going to have a Facebook page as an Olympic association or any sporting association, unless you update it on a daily basis, unless you keep giving them information, people stop looking at it. And websites are exactly the same. If you can't find the news, I mean, the story with a website is they tell you if you can't find it in two clicks, people go elsewhere.
Well, it's interesting because I was trying to find some results from Indian domestic hockey for the Reverse Stick podcast. And, you know, they've got all over social media Hockey India, they're posting up, these are the fixtures today, these are the results, that's great. But nowhere can you go on their website and get a pool. Can you get a table? What do these results mean? And the results aren't actually on their website. It's only posted through social media. And it was just infuriating to try and get some information about what is happening in Indian domestic hockey. We want to know. We want to tell all the people about it. And this website is totally useless.
But this is the thing again, is if you're going to update all of those things, there's a cost because you need to have somebody that's dedicated to do that. And then, of course, they need a holiday at some point in the year, so no, someone else needs to step in and do that. And you need your website. You need your social media. And you need, I mean, again, if you look at social media and some of that, you get more engagement if you put video clips than you do if you put just normal posts. So you need to have a certain percentage of your posts need to be done as a video clip.
And the other side of social media is it's a two-way street. It is not a one-way street, FIH, who seem to think that they can just plaster out all sorts of irrelevant rubbish and they're doing a good job. You can't, they call it engagement. The marketing people love that term, engagement. Oh, we're engaging you. You're not engaging people when you ignore their questions. When people ask you something through social media, answer.
Well, that's not as bad as a lot of these associations and clubs now. If you ask a question that they do not want, or you make a comment that they do not like, and I will say this without swear words in it, but if you hit a raw nerve, it's deleted. You know, and that to me is, if you're in that presence, you need to cop the criticism and take all the praise when it's appropriate.
Yeah, I must admit a couple of my comments have disappeared off social media posts that were a bit too hard for them to answer. It's no good just jumping up and down and telling us how wonderful you are and then ignoring serious, legitimate questions from stakeholders. I am a stakeholder. So answer my bloody question, I pay your wages.
Look, I think the hard thing again there, and I'm not defending, but you get a lot of people who just come out with inane comments, but there are sometimes people who know what's going on that come out with informed decisions, comments, questions, and whatever, and those people you can't afford to ignore. So again, if you're in that role, you can't just put some 19-year-old kid who happens to be keen on the sport, knows a little bit about it. It needs to have somebody with a level of maturity who has the linguistic skills to be able to answer those queries, comments, criticisms in a way that is not going to inflame a situation rather than deleting.
Well, the strength of a sport is in how it responds to bad things, not how it responds to good things. And if you just try and ignore the bad things and wash them under the carpet, people see it for what it is, and you lose all credibility, and they no longer listen to what you're saying, even when they're good things.
Well, hopefully this was a good podcast and that you're going to listen again, because we're going to bring this one to a close. But we thank you for joining us once again on Not the Footy Show. And please, if you have a comment, we will reply. I promise you.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.